Welcome to our daily work, our daily lives. This is the last one of the semester, and it's our 25th year. So we will, you know, start again in the fall. I'm not sure what we're going to do in terms of in-person or Zoom. It might be a combination of the two. The MSU Museum, where we currently reside as a program, isn't open to the public right now that I'm aware of. So in that way, we have to kind of wait and see what's going to happen with that. But thanks for attending today. Shannon Kirkwood is our speaker. Shannon, hey, Bill and Kathy. And Shannon did her PhD here in Michigan at Central Michigan University, right, Shannon? Mm-hmm.
Yep.
And so we're very happy to have her on the Zoom, even though she's currently living in Kansas City, Missouri. Okay. Independent scholar there, trying to finish the book for publication. So, we look forward to seeing it in print. Shannon and I first met when she was doing other work, that is, than what she's talking about today, or some.
It's related. It is.
So we're very happy to have Shannon here. She's going to be speaking on the topic Inside the Early 20th Century Working Class Family, Kin, Work, and Neighborhood. So I'll turn it over to Shannon. So nice to have you here, Shannon.
Thanks. So when we say the working class family, kin, work, and neighborhood, mostly what we're talking about is working class housewives. And this is a class of people that both labor historians and women's historians have had a lot of difficulty really getting a hold of as far as a subject, for a variety of reasons. For labor history, for a long time, the focus was on unions and institutions and the process of unionizing workplaces. But of course, housewives are not wage workers. They don't work in an industrial setting per se. So they weren't covered in that. They also are sort of missed out in the new labor history, which focuses on sort of cultural and leisure activities, because a lot of that, especially as pertaining to women, focuses on young single women going to dance halls, the sort of the leisure time that married women just don't have. With the pocket money that they also don't have. So the one place in labor and class studies where they do get a little bit of a peek in is in the sort of the ethno studies of various ethnic groups. Pick your ethnic group, the Italians, Russian Jews, the Finns, whoever it may be, Poles, whoever. So they often do feature there, but at the expense of recognizing a common experience. A lot of ethnic studies, which are very good, a lot of them are very good, do tend to sort of take the viewpoint of this group of people are exceptional in this place. They do all these amazing things, which nobody else does, which if you read enough of them, you realize isn't true at all. For women's history, especially in the early 20th century, they miss out on working class housewives as well, in part because there is, at this point in history, there is a focus on suffrage campaigns and a lot of sort of the new woman, the early feminism, that again working class housewives are not participating in large numbers, and they would not necessarily have the same aims, values, priorities that middle class women are having at this point. So we do see them occasionally when women's historians are writing about reformers or social workers and their sort of their interactions with these women, but they're rarely the focus, and it's rarely from their own perspective. It's from the perspective of the reformer or the whether that be the Women's Trade Union League or Sarah Deutsch's I think it's called City Women, or is that Women in the City, something like that, can't remember offhand, does a really good job of this in that she follows reformers and social workers into working class women's homes, but doesn't give us their viewpoint per se. Also, and it's the same, women's history also like the working women, the same as labor history. They like the women who join unions. They like the women who go to work in men's occupations and who earn a living. And this, so there is a little bit of that. They focus on the same groups of women that labor history do, which leaves out working class housewives. So no one is really sure what to do with these women. There have been a few scholars, Laurie Mercier and Elizabeth Foe as well, who have looked at them as sort of co-participants in the labor movement in the 30s and 40s during the rise of the CIO. And then the subsequent auxiliary movement. But with somewhat of a, well, they're not very radical, they're not very exciting, but this is what we have to work with sort of approach. So what I am doing with this project is looking at married women in an earlier period in the progressive era, up until about 1920. So the sort of, I guess, the second wave of the labor movement. So this is the rise of the AFL along with the IWW and some other sort of independent unions before the CIO. And looking at how these women, number one, understand their role in the working class, how they understand their own identity, and how they are understanding the sort of the politics and the labor movement that's going on around them, and in some cases, sometimes including them and sometimes just passing them by. So, it's impossible to have a complete history of the working class and labor movements without understanding women's part, especially married women's part in both. And it's impossible to answer questions about working class women's lifestyles until we can examine them from a class as well as from a gendered angle and acknowledge that they don't necessarily have to share the same perspectives and goals. You know, there's not as much as we would sometimes want there to be. There is no sort of women's sisterhood all sort of pushing toward the same aims. So it's important, I think, to sort of meet these women where they are and to see, try to uncover what it is and how it is they felt about their own lives, about their own participation in whatever politics or movements are going on, and what they valued as a class and a group of women. So how do we start to integrate both class and gender? The number one way is a discussion of space, how it's divided, how it's used, and who controls it. So this automatically means that we're talking about the house. occupation and use of space clearly shapes the conception of self and the understanding of one's place in the world, as well as one's priorities. And it helps to explain why working class women made the choices that they did and their attitude toward the labor movement and a variety of other subjects. Now, what's on top of that, it's important to make the observation that the arguments I'm about to make are by and large fairly, the principles and the practices are universally present and hold steady across ethnic groups and different localities, regardless of how recently they immigrated. If they immigrated at all, they might be working class American natives, as it were, or they might be new, old stock, they could be anything, but it is not their ethnic or cultural background which dictates these developments. It's their economic situation. And this is also despite whatever occupation their sort of male counterparts happen to be in. So there is a, there has been a push recently to kind of compare similar industrial sites. So like mining camps or miners' wives or, you know, whatever, or railroad workers' wives, as that being a common thread. But I'm arguing that it doesn't have anything to do with the male occupation. It has everything to do with the development of their neighborhoods and their networks and just their economic situation, regardless of what their husbands are doing. And actually, this is, it's a stray observation that was made by Roy Rosenzweig, actually, where he sort of, in 8 Hours for What We Will, which as John and I were just discussing, is almost 40 years old, he makes a stray observation. And I'll read it for you here, because I think it is worth sort of remembering. And he says, despite the separateness, diversity, and even animosity, these disparate working class communities also shared similar structures of life, a common location, a similar occupational and a similar occupational structure. And although immigrants had little to do with each other, their daily lives followed the same rhythm, the common experience of low pay, long hours, and unsafe work pattern their lives in the most fundamental ways. And then he goes on to say that family and kin networks, churches, and women's groups defined the working class experience, as did the houses they lived in. And then he goes on, of course, to not talk about women hardly at all. I will also say that this is not only an American phenomenon, but is occurring in what I call the Anglo world. So this is the United States, Canada, Britain, and possibly also Australia, though I know less about those. And at this point, they're less industrially developed in Australia and New Zealand than they are in US, Canada, and Great Britain. And my examples will be pulled from, I did a series of three case studies for this work, one in the Copper Country in Michigan, one in Glasgow in 1915, right during the rent strike. And then I also looked at Seattle, sort of on the eve of the general strike. So it's over this this decade from about 1910 to 1920. Okay, so argument number one, as it were, there is not one working class the way we like to talk about it. There are two. There's the male working class and the female working class. And they occupy, by and large, except for the short amount of space that women spend time in their sort of late teens and early 20s that they spend out working, these two worlds are almost completely separate. So if you imagine almost a bicycle wheel, and in the center you have the women's world of the home, and rotating around it is the men's world of the work, the pub, the fraternity, whatever it is. And we know a lot about the male world, the workplace, the fraternities, the bars, the taverns, the union halls, and even the sporting events. We don't know a whole lot about women's world, in part because it leaves so behind so few traces.
Lifestyle that ensures convenience, comfort, and security while optimizing.
Hello. it just leaves behind so few actual physical traces. An artist, Cameron, argues that in times of upheaval, say during a strike, that women lend their spaces, their kitchens, their stairs, their front steps to men to use for their labor struggles. So this suggests a sort of a zone of female authority. To lend something to someone, you have to actually be the possessor and controller of it. So I would take that two steps sort of further. Oh, there's the boy. Hi, sweet pea.
Oh, he's working, honey.
I didn't say.
We will see
you
later.
I will see you in a little bit, okay?
We're going to go back to the house, and I'm going to get you a lovely sandwich, okay?
Okay.
Workplace is the home, right?
Yeah. So this lending of space, as I say, signifies control over it, and that women also actively sought their own spaces in the working class world and in the labor movement as well. They very jealously guard their space and carve out spaces for themselves that don't have any male input. So argument number two, for this presentation there, I actually have four, but you're only getting the first two because otherwise we'd be here forever. The primary female space is the home, and for all that we think about the home as being a place where people come at the end of the day to relax or do yard work or whatever it is that we think about, the home is not a place of rest, but a place of work for working class housewives. It is, and they even go so far as to think of it as their point of production, much in the same way that men think of their factories or workshops or whatever as their points of production. So the work inside the home allows the male world to continue to operate. So the things that the men and the children, whoever, need to go out into the world, clean clothes, lunches, whatever it is that they need, is produced in the home by the housewives. They cannot go to work. Well, it's frowned upon for them to go to work in dirty clothes, without food, without whatever. And we know that the women of the copper country believe this. And we can tell almost universally in any place where women, where housewives are participating in strikes, where they're trying to get people to not cross the picket line, they go after the clothes. They muck up the clothes, they steal lunch pails, they do all of this ostensibly to convince these picket crossing men's wives that their crossing of the picket is gonna mean more work for them. So don't let your men cross the picket. Otherwise, we're gonna make you have a whole lot more work. So we can kind of see this expression of women's belief in their work in this way. Through some of these actions. In Glasgow, the women of Glasgow believed this as well. They took pride, vocal pride, in sort of the taking care of their menfolk. Oh, my husband never goes out in a wrinkled shirt or whatever. And in Seattle, women routinely refer, so there's a sort of an auxiliary movement of these working class housewives, and they forever are referring to themselves and to each other as workers within the home. And there's a push across the board to get more sort of official training and to confer professional status on housekeeping. So this comes from everything from requesting you need to add an economics course. The college in Washington are teaching economics courses. They get professional certificates. I have completed my home economics course. I am now a professional housekeeper. It's a skilled trade. They push this idea of it being a skilled trade and profession throughout the decade. And this also kind of then leads to sort of talk about, well, if it's a skilled trade, what is their compensation for this skilled trade? And their compensation comes in two forms, regard and respect among other women in the community, and the expectation that the men, whoever he may be, whether it be sons or brothers or whoever, will hand over a full pay packet. I do this work in here, so you will hand me your full pay packet. This led to sort of two measures of economic success within a family. One was how much the man actually earned, and the second was how much he actually gave you. And of course, everyone in the community knows, or at least suspects, how much any individual woman is getting. And there's quite a bit of sort of shame associated with not getting the full packet or having to ask for more of the packet. So a woman's housekeeping skills and her ability to both take a whole pay packet and then spend it wisely determined her rank in the neighborhood and in the neighborhood pecking order. And women would patrol these boundaries. They would shame men who were caught too often in the bar not handing over the pay packet, but they would also perhaps less drastically, women would sort of develop reputations of, oh, her stoop isn't as clean as it could be, or that family there doesn't take their turn cleaning out the outhouse, or whatever it happens to be. So this arrangement clearly leads to some ambivalence among married women about the goals of the labor movement. Because there's no such thing for a married woman as an 8-hour day or a weekend. There, yes, they cared about wages, but only up to a point, because it didn't matter how much a man was earning if he could not be compelled to hand over the whole pay packet. So there's sort of this disconnect in the sort of social agreement between men and women of what men's earnings are and then what they're expected to do with them. And women always knew, and this is why they value their household so much. Women always knew that they could supplement men's wages with their own domestic labor. So on the one hand, that means being frugal and expanding every penny. But on the other hand, it also means they can expand their labor to bring in more. It's part of the home economy. And for a lot of historians, the home economy by this point in the 20th century is sort of a dying thing. But for the working class, it survives really. I would say up until at least the Second World War, in that they know they can take in laundry, they know they can take in sewing, they can take in boarders, even if they only have two rooms in which to do all this. They know that, you know, they can put the boarder in the spare room and all the, and all, the whole family, however many of them, can live in the kitchen or whatever. This happens in the Copper Country, where they subdivide the company housing, which is meant for single families. Basically, all of the rooms, except for maybe two for the family, are given over to the running of boarding houses. This happens in Glasgow, where the typical tenement setup is the room and kitchen, where you have a room and a kitchen, and the boarder gets the room. And so at this, and in Seattle as well, we don't, there's less sort of information about this because of the source base, but at one point, a woman writes into the women's pages of the Seattle Union Record and says, I need extra cash and I have small kids. What can I do? And the editor just lists off, you can take in boarders, you can have a garden, you can do this, that, and the other thing. Almost as if I am so bored of giving this exact same answer. Like, these are your choices. And sometimes, especially if you had a lot of boarders, the earnings that a woman could take in through that expansion of her labor could exceed, match, or even exceed what her husband was bringing in a month as well. Depending, it not always, but if you were lucky, if you were in the right space, like the Copper Country, where you had a lot of single men, and a high sort of population turnover, this was a great way to basically make money out of your housekeeping. And this is in part why women are pushing for home economics classes. It is a form of working class feminism, because they're saying, look, I want my daughter to be able to be as economically independent as she can, and the way that we're doing this is through housekeeping. And it's very different from what we think of as feminism. Like, no one is arguing, I want my daughter in physics classes, I want my daughter to be, you know, whatever, doctor, lawyer, whatever it happens to be. It's, I want my daughter to be able to earn a living off of her housekeeping, or at least survive off of her own housekeeping, no matter what her life circumstances happens to be. This will change. By 1920, you do have, with the experience of the war and also with changing technology, you do have a lot of working class sort of daughters who can easily, or relatively easily with little overhead, get into the sort of the white collar professions through clerical work. So you do start to see a shift after the war with the advent of more affordable college courses, and also the sort of the advent of this clerical work. You do see that begin to happen, but it takes a long time, or becoming telephone operators, or whatever it happens to be. But at this point, sort of just before the war and during, the housewives know that that's what they have to do. They have to supplement their earnings with their own domestic work. And so this becomes the other root of the ambivalence toward the labor movement, because the labor movement doesn't hold much regard for the difficulty of women's housework. And none of their efforts at this point are focused on easing women's domestic burdens. And a lot of the strategies that are employed by the labor movement actually make women's lives harder. So strikes, boycotts, and the pushing of the union label, that basically means that women have to work harder for no actual firsthand reward. Like, yeah, their men will if it's successful, then potentially their men will have steadier and higher wages. But again, that's sort of a secondary or even tertiary effect that they may not even feel in their daily experiences. So that's why, you know, when unions are complaining, all these housewives, they don't understand what we're doing. They do understand. They're just kind of peeved off that the labor movements and the unions aren't looking at them and going, how can we help you? They're sort of, if they're thought of at all, it's a second or third or even fourth thought. So reformers and historians later had many misconceptions about working class women's homes. They assumed it was a prison and that the working class women were doomed to an isolated life of never-ending work and childbirth. And while the amounts of work and childbirth may be an accurate depiction, it neglects the fact that women were proud of their homes and that their work in them helped to shape their identities, just as work did for their male counterparts. To the extent that you have not only women being very house proud in sort of very not great circumstances, but even going so far as to like wallpaper like temporary homes and like taking a lot of care to make their domestic spaces as enjoyable as possible for themselves. And the home was also the point around which women built their networks. So all of this work and childcare and whatnot is made easier and by making it into a social occasion. So women always, to the extent that they could, they worked together. Neighbors helped each other with cooking, baking, laundry, childcare. They took breaks in each other's kitchens. They did laundry together. They watched each other's kids. And this state of affairs, you find this everywhere. Women popping in and out of each other's houses. When people talk about in working class neighborhoods, oh, we never locked our doors. Well, it's because if you did, your neighbor couldn't come in to help you with whatever it was because you had your hands full. A woman in Seattle writes in to the editor complaining about, I have this neighbor, she won't go away and she's very annoying. And the editor is like, well, unless you move somewhere where you don't have neighbors, this is just gonna be a thing you have to deal with. And she calls it a penalty of being a woman, which is different than the way a lot of women at this point talk about their neighbors. I mean, they squabble amongst each other, but it does show, because this editor is obviously a sort of a professional working woman. And so she's looking at these working class patterns as kind of old fashioned and a bit annoying. And she does eventually suggest to the woman writing in, well, you know, if you both had work outside the home, then there wouldn't be time for daily visits and whatnot. So her perspective is a little different, a little, this is later, this is about 1918 that she's writing this. So she is one of these new professional women who's starting to emerge at this point. So her perspective is a bit more callous than the way people remember in oral histories their neighbors and their neighborhoods and that sort of thing. And the community, these community ties were strengthened by familial ones as well as ethnic ones. So often daughters in particular would not move very far from their mothers to the extent that they could stay in the spot where they were born if their husbands had employment. And you do tend to see in places like the Copper Country where it's ethnic groups living in boarding houses, they do tend to immigrate sort of en masse, like whole villages come and just relocate themselves all in one boarding house. So they build these, if not strictly familial, then certainly very close networks of kin and neighbors and whoever they can get. And then this then extended to spaces outside the homes where women had to do their work also. So laundry houses and places where they had bath houses, where again, it was segregated. Men and women would be in different bath houses. Men would never step into laundry houses. They would never, even things such as like doing the grocery shopping, men did not tend to go into grocery stores I suppose grocery stores a little modern, but what at that point were the shops to the point where there's a story of a man in Glasgow who had a shop, and he would hang the men's caps just outside or just inside the door so that the men could sort of lean in, take a cap, pay for it, and not have to enter the store because it was just too shameful to go into a store because that was women's work. And out of these, they also established social groups. And these groups, although they were called different things and they weren't all like the same, it's not like you can find, like now you can find a YMCA just about everywhere. It's not that sort of universal thing. These are sort of simultaneous, spontaneous groups that develop in a location, but their function stays pretty much the same. So, and they all serve a sort of a niche. And they have sort of three, a set of nesting purposes. Number one, obviously, is sociability. A chance to practice domestic skills and to learn new ones. So this is your sewing circles or your coffee clashes where they pass recipes back and forth or whatever they happen to be. And then a chance for self-improvement and the development of other skills. So this is glee clubs, debate clubs, reading groups, all of this activity. And then out of that, women begin to realize, hey, we have a lot in common with each other. We have a shared experience. In some places, there is some inter-ethnic sort of recognition of this, but we're still about a decade away from the sort of more complete homogenization in that sense. And then from this, they begin to articulate their needs, their own sort of goals for the labor movement, for their own lives, for their political needs, their economic needs, all these things. And they are sometimes, they're working certainly alongside unions and that sort of thing, but they're not always, they'll go and propose things to labor leaders and whatnot. And labor leaders often will go either we'll see, or, and this is almost universal, socialists in general love to say, yes, that's a great idea. And when the socialist revolution in utopia comes, we will implement it. Great. and they are thinking about, can we have communal daycares? Can we have shared kitchens? Can we have co-op housing? Can we do all of these things? And when the labor movement is doing well, there's more room for experimentation. But if there's a recession or a strike goes badly or something, the unions immediately, they close ranks and they shrink their agendas and jettison anyone who is not officially part of their ranks, which is all of the married women, and they jettison all of the social programs and all of the ideas that they have to focus on hours, safeties, wages. The bread and butter of the labor movement. So by 1920, women, this rather puts working class housewives in a bizarre position in that they want to participate, they understand what's going on, but they're kind of shuffled to the side of the main action as the labor movement is under threat from red scares and recessions and all kinds of things that happen in the 20s. So conclusions. The key to understanding working class women's involvement in understanding of the labor movement and other working class movements rests on understanding how they viewed their home, their family, their ethnic and neighborhood networks. Tension between working class men and women was in their disagreement over whether the home was a place of work or not. And women closely protected their spaces and sought to carve out spaces, sort of more public spaces of their own, separate from their male counterparts. They derived a fair amount of autonomous power from these homosocial spaces and networks, despite their substantial economic dependence on their male partners. And these surroundings resulted in the development of a separate but parallel female class consciousness that, while broadly in line with the goals of men's organizations, occasionally had their own priorities, which caused friction within the working class and the labor movement. And ultimately, as the movement became more institutionalized and homogeneous, women's goals were often sidelined and opportunities for their participation were greatly reduced.
Well, great. Well, Shannon, thank you so much for that. I think we'll open it up. I've got, and by the way, just to make that public, you know, part of my research has been on the Copper Country, as you well know, Shannon. So I automatically, you know, my ears perked up. So there's some things to talk about. So let me open it up, questions or comments on Shannon's look at working class women in this period. Any questions? Because let me just start, jump into this. During the 1913 Michigan copper strike, and I assume maybe in Glasgow and in Seattle as well, if you did take in boarders, they were unemployed by the strike just like your husband was.
Yep.
So your source of, your extra source of income became
problematic. Gone also.
Mm-hmm. You know, immediately. And you weren't going to put those folks out. That is because if your husband was a striker, these guys were strikers, you're not gonna do that. So I mean it's actually more work, mm-hmm, in effect for the woman at that point, because she's trying to keep an extended household,
yep,
going when there is no money coming in, very little money in the way of relief from the union or otherwise.
And on top of that, the boarding houses keep getting raided because they're looking for whoever they're looking for. And this is their number one complaint when they go before Congress and saying, look, I'm just here in my house, not really doing anything. And these sheriffs keep coming and flipping my house over. So
okay, great.
Other
questions or comments? Is that Jim, by the way? I'm not sure if, so questions or comments? Because I've got a page full. So I think one thing that you're talking about, I mean, and naturally historians, and not only historians, but others have talked about this whole notion of separate spheres, that is the home and the occupation. And one thing that made that easy, frankly, is that the hours were often so long that husbands only came home to sleep.
Yep.
That is, you didn't see them a lot. But one thing is that in mining, you said that it might not differ from place to place, but the heightened notion of precariousness based on the fact that your husband could die on the job, mm-hmm, and fairly common in a place like the Copper Country.
Yeah.
Miners were dying weekly of rock falls and other things in the mines. So I guess I'm interested in the idea that, you know, that you've got a heightened sense of precariousness in some locations compared to others. It's not like there's death on the job in some of the occupations that, I mean, in shipbuilding in Glasgow, it very well may be that there was a number of people who died, but nothing compared to miners, for example.
Well, despite the precariousness of the men's occupation, whatever happens to be, and part of what makes this fascinating is that in each of the places that I look at, the main occupation is different. It's mining in Michigan, shipbuilding in Glasgow. In Seattle, they have a whole mix of things because the shipbuilding there comes online for the war, and that kind of lies on top of what was already there. And really, in all circumstances, the precariousness of keeping the house is the thing that women are most concerned about. So even if a man were to die, if a woman has, this is in part why the gold standard at this point for working class people is to buy their own houses. This is what they want, because the women are like, even if the husband were to die, I can still do all these other economic things until either my son or whatever is earning, or until I marry again. So that's why, and in the copper country as well, you see the women's auxiliary, they don't come into real, they're sort of hanging out, but they don't really get really involved until the week that eviction notices start going out. Like that's when they're like, oh no, now they're threatening our houses. Like, so it's this real, whether or not women get involved in labor disputes, whether or not women sort of, all the choices that they make is about keeping the house as stable as possible, because without it, they don't have any other options if a man were to die or get injured or whatever.
Questions or comments? I'm going to keep them coming. I've got my list unless somebody else wants to jump in. Question? Well, by the way, Shannon, I love, and just to make sure that we all understand that, often called bucket brigades, and women's auxiliaries would take buckets of stuff from the outhouse and brooms, and then would, as you put it, muck up the
whoever it was, and they like to
the line crossers.
They like to throw flower bombs as well. That, like, you can find that almost anywhere where they're just chucking like flour or suet or whatever at. If an outhouse is not available per se, they have all kinds of things from their kitchen.
It just happens that, I guess I wouldn't use flour because the fact that if I'm on strike, flour is a rare commodity at that point.
Well, in Glasgow, it was
An outhouse is a useful thing because, everything is going to waste, so to speak. Anyway, what I was going to raise is, bucket brigades like that have been present all the way back to the 1870s forward. Yep. All mining communities would take on line crossers in strikes with bucket brigades. And I don't think you see bucket brigades in a lot of other locations compared to, for some reason, in mining camps, they're a huge issue.
The mining camps are particularly gross because they do have these public outhouses.
Yeah.
But as I say, in Glasgow, especially when people would come to evict whoever it was, it's the suet bombs that they chuck, which is just as hard. It's not perhaps as dramatic as excrement, but it's just as hard to get out. Unfortunately, with Seattle, the women's auxiliary are sidelined so early, even before the general strike, that I don't have many examples of this particular phenomenon for them, but you find it everywhere that women are doing public demonstrations, which involve a little bit of violence. It's whatever the muckiest thing they have in their kitchen, and they throw.
Well, and I love the argument you're making, Shannon, because what you're saying is that it was working women really trying to reach out to the wives of these line crossers saying, you're going to pay the price.
Yep.
That is, if I steal his lunch bucket, you know, you're going to have to figure out how to feed him otherwise.
Yeah.
Or if I get him all mucked up with stuff, you're going to have to clean those clothes later. Naturally, a lot of those, and I think of the Copper Country, a lot of those line crossers were single men who had just come into the Copper Country for the purpose of taking jobs. And so it was an extra expense for them. That is, it was taking money out of their, if they were getting paid to scab on the mine strike, they would have to pay to get the clothes. And chances are they didn't have many clothes to begin with. Mm-hmm. That is, most people did not have extensive wardrobes, to say the least. The other thing that, the precariousness, we have a lot of examples in American labor history of the separate spheres break down because men bring dangerous things into the home. Best example being asbestos. Asbestos miners would bring asbestos home on their clothes. Ultimately, it very well may be that it affected the wives and family members as much as it, not as much necessarily as the actual miner who was mining the asbestos, but it is something significant in terms of that it's not as easy, the separate spheres thing, because these people are living in mining camps. You're often living in
very housing. Tight quarters. It's very tight quarters. And the separate spheres, as even in middle class families, it's more of an ideology than it always is sort of practiced, sort of absolutely. And there is no, working class women knew that their home was not this sort of protected bubble. They understood that.
Yeah.
But it's more that anytime they could, they shoot everybody out of the house. Because and this is men on strike, this is men after work, this is children, this is whatever, like, go somewhere else. Because I only have this much space and I have like 20,000 things to do and you are in the way.
It's interesting because but the other argument that you're making is the place that men often went, which was a tavern, is not a place that the wife wants that man in the tavern because it's going to depress the amount of money she has to be able to use.
Well, I mean, this is complicated a little by the fact that fraternities and unions even did a lot of their operations out of taverns.
Yeah.
The Italian Hall, of course, in the Copper Country had a working tavern in its downstairs. And it's one of the few, at this point, it's one of the few public spaces where working class men can go without and be alone without sort of like other people watching them. Because they can't, street corners are forever off limits. Parks are kind of this middle ground, but those are often at this point, especially, there are people who are sort of watching over parks to make sure that like children are playing correctly and like all of this. So you have a lot of middle class reformers who are very invested in the parks at this point. So they can't really go there. They have in some places they might have like a reading room or a library or something specifically for them. And then there's the various sporting places, baseball in the United States, football in Britain, football in Canada, and hockey later as well. Like this, so they have. So it is a little counterintuitive, but often if they could do it, and this you see this in the Copper Country, they have where they have yards. There's clearly like a recreational area for like nine pins or whatever, which was what the Putrick household was doing when the Seaborville murders occurred. They were out in the yard playing nine pins. And so you can imagine the sort of the matron, like, go outside, I have to clean up after dinner, you know? So there is a little bit of tension there. But ideally, if it has all worked out correctly, if he has handed over his whole pay packet, she then gives him pocket money to go and do the men things.
One thing, and again, just because, let me do a quick commercial. I was happy to advise Mary Doria Russell on her book, Women of the Copper Country. Mm-hmm. Unfortunately, she ignored a lot of my historical advice and totally rewrote the history of the copper strike. But that aside, that's been chosen by the Michigan Humanities Council as the Great Michigan Read this coming year. So if you're interested, it's a great novel, even if it is historically incorrect.
Yeah, but no, I was doing some work up there on a different subject. The National Park hired me to look at their suffrage activity up there.
Yeah.
And that it had come up in conversation. So
anyway, the point that she makes, and I think that would probably be of interest to folks, is that whole notion that women getting involved in women's auxiliaries or at all being involved in strike activity often pitted women against women, because women began to wonder whether or not any of these women were trying to take away their husbands by being involved in some of the auxiliary work, or if they were involved in strike activity. This goes on in a number of strikes later, especially if any single women
mm-hmm.
were being involved. They were suspect, even if they happened to be, politically connected to the labor movement in one way or another.
Sure.
So let me, any other comments or questions for Shannon? For those of you who came in late, we found out that Suzanne Sorkin was the doctor that delivered Shannon in Sparrow Hospital years ago.
1985.
So, I mean, a small world on these calls. So any other questions or comments? Because unfortunately, Shannon's husband is about to start teaching on this same computer in a few minutes. So we had to make sure that she could get out early enough to allow that to happen. So let me just thank Shannon again. Thank Shannon, wonderful stuff. I look forward to the book, and we'll be in touch on some other bibliography stuff just for the fun of it. But all of you, I'll be in touch about next year's schedule and also about any other kinds of activities that are coming up that you might be interested in. Let me actually mention one. And if you're interested, please do get a hold of me. But next Monday night, we have a panel in the other thing I run on campus, Sharper Focus, Wider Lens, that looks at interdisciplinary world. There are a number of scholars who are going to be talking about being at the cutting edge. All of them are university distinguished professors talking about the latest thing in research in higher education, public health, engineering, the head of the FRIB, our rare isotope beam facility, and someone who's looking at conjure feminism, which has to do with the working knowledge of Black women. and the kinds of things that we understand in terms of what they've brought to advancing knowledge. So if you're interested, beckj@msu.edu, I'll be happy to send you the link for that next Monday night, 7 o'clock, sponsored by the Honors College. So thanks again for everyone being involved. It's so good to see you all, and we'll be in touch. So have a great day.
Thank you.
Bye. Thank you.